This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 6th, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Aaron Glantz, filling in for Aldo Bogado.
A small number of suspected terrorist leaders and operatives captured during the war have been held and questioned outside the United States.
George Bush admits the Central Intelligence Agency has been flying security detainees to secret prisons around the world. Israel's Auditor General proposes a criminal investigation of Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. And right-wing presidential candidate Felipe Calderon starts forming a government in Mexico. His left-wing rival says he'll never recognize the results. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Tony Blair's future as Britain's prime minister and leader of his party appears to be under threat, as seven members of his government resigned today in protest of his leadership. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The political opposition is describing it as a meltdown for Tony Blair's party. Seven members of parliament, all in junior government positions, resigned today, and more may follow. Efforts to oust him by his own party and members of parliament have been gathering momentum for some time. Even ex-government ministers have called on him to step down for what they see as the good of his party and the country. Many see Tony Blair's strong alliance with George Bush, his support for the war in Iraq, and his failure to condemn the bombings in Lebanon as the straws that broke the camel's back. According to polls, the popularity ratings of his government are now at a 19-year low. With an invigorated political opposition on the rise, Labour Party MPs are worried that Tony Blair has become a liability to future election success and to their parliamentary seats. Ministers loyal to Tony Blair have said that he'll be gone within a year, but the question now may be whether he can last that long. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A statement released today by the Office of the Israeli Prime Minister says that Israel will lift its two-month-long sea and air blockade of Lebanon tomorrow. International forces will take control of Lebanese seaports and airports. Israeli attacks on the Palestinian territories have continued, killing eight Palestinians since last night. This as a general strike throughout the Palestinian territories protests the international economic blockade that has resulted in the non-payment of salaries of government workers for over 6 months. Syed Benora reports.
Two separate Israeli airstrikes last night killed four Palestinians in southern Gaza in apparent assassination attempts against Palestinian resistance fighters. Early this morning in Gaza, three people were killed and three injured, most of them members of the same family. All were civilians. Meanwhile, a general strike has continued for the second day, with Palestinian teachers and workers protesting an international siege and blockade that has prevented the payment of salaries to Palestinian Authority employees since March. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian legislator.
It is very strange that Israel is so severe in its attacks against Palestinians exactly at a point when all Palestinian groups agreed on a national platform, a common document. In my opinion, there are only two ways of dealing with this situation. Either Israel breaks down more wars and then it's an endless vicious cycle of violence, or we could all go now to an international peace conference on the basis of that program.
Israel also continues to abduct Palestinian political figures. The head of the Palestinian Presidential Security Force was taken prisoner at a checkpoint last night, joining over 80 other government officials that have been seized by Israel since June. For Afasaran from imemc.org, this is Saad Banoura in Beit Sahour, Palestine.
The Senate today rejected an amendment to the 2007 defense spending bill that would have outlawed the use of cluster bombs in or near civilian areas. The Pentagon opposed the amendment brought by California Senator Dianne Feinstein and Vermont's Patrick Leahy. Cluster bombs disperse explosive devices over a wide range of territory. The smaller bomblets can remain buried and active in areas long after the end of an armed conflict, posing danger to local civilians. At least two Lebanese soldiers were killed today as they were clearing away unexploded cluster bombs in the south of the country. The Israeli army reportedly used three different types of U.S.-manufactured cluster bombs during its 34-day campaign in Lebanon. Representatives from South Korea and the U.S. are in Seattle today for a third round of talks aimed at implementing a free trade agreement between the two countries. Mark Taylor Canfield reports.
The first two rounds of talks on the controversial free trade agreement between the U.S. and South Korea took place in Washington, D.C. and Seoul and resulted in major protests. according to Chi Young Kim, an organizer with the U.S.-based solidarity coalition Koreans Against War and Neoliberalism, South Korean farmers are facing a major struggle for survival.
Korea currently grows about 65% of its rice. With this free trade agreement, if it were to happen, the rice market would open up and cheaper U.S. rice would flood the market. You would drive the farmers out of their land and their homes. But it's not only the farmers themselves, but also all businesses related to agriculture.
The free trade agreement talks between the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to continue through Friday in Seattle, with activists planning events through Sunday. This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush today admitted the Central Intelligence Agency has been flying prisoners to secret detention centers around the world without government oversight. Then, in the same speech in the East Room of the White House, he presented Congress with a plan for them to create legal tribunals to try detainees at Guantanamo Bay. As Bush made those announcements, Democratic leaders in the Senate presented a measure of no confidence in Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
In a speech in the East Room of the White House, the president said he will transfer all 14 suspected terrorists held in secret CIA-run prisons to Guantanamo Bay Detention Center.
The current transfers mean that there are now no terrorists in the CIA program.
The CIA prisons will remain open. This is just a small fraction of the more than 1,000 prisoners that rights groups estimate to be held at CIA prisons. In the past, the administration has denied the existence of these prisons, but now President Bush calls the prisons critical for obtaining intelligence information. The president claims he has in custody the masterminds behind the September 11th bombings, and the reason for their transfer, according to the president, is to put the men on trial.
As soon as Congress acts to authorize the military commissions I have proposed, the men our intelligence officials believe orchestrated the deaths of nearly 3,000 Americans on September the 11th, 2001, can face justice.
Also Wednesday, the president sent legislation to Congress to approve military tribunals to try the more than 500 detainees remaining at Guantanamo Bay. The Supreme Court ruled the military tribunal system illegal in June in the case Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. The court said they didn't provide enough protections for defendants, and also because Congress never approved the tribunals. Republican leadership in the House and the Senate have placed top priority in authorizing the president's legislation. It's a key component of their tough-on-terrorism agenda in the lead-up to the midterm elections. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist plans to introduce the legislation for the administration later tonight or tomorrow. But some members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, are deeply concerned about some of the provisions. Critics say the defendants aren't given enough rights. Republican Senator John McCain from Arizona and member of the Armed Services Committee.
I think it's important that we stand by 200 years of legal precedence concerning classified information, because the defendant should have the right to know what evidence is being used against the defendant, and a judge, as in normal proceedings, can make those decisions so that there's not a violation of national security.
Senator McCain is supporting alternative legislation offered by the chair of the Armed Services Committee, John Warner from Virginia. They believe their legislation addresses their concerns. A third piece of legislation by Republican Senator Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania would also amend the tribunals. It's up to Majority Leader Frist, though, if one or all three pieces of legislation will be offered. Since the Supreme Court ruling, critics have come out against military tribunals because of their lack of structure and regulation. They say there's already a system in place to try detainees. They're called courts martial. Courts martial are used to try members of the U.S. military. But opponents say courts martial provide the defendant with more rights than a U.S. citizen. Rights suspected terrorists don't deserve, they say. Also being worked out in both Congress and the White House is a new military training manual for torture. It has outlawed some torture techniques such as waterboarding, but only U.S. military personnel must follow the guidelines, but not members of the CIA who have in custody many detainees.
And on the floor of the Senate, Democrats introduced an amendment to the defense spending bill. It's a symbolic resolution that says the U.S. needs a new direction in Iraq and a new leader of military planning at the Pentagon. It's a statement of no confidence of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid from Nevada.
Mr. President, this amendment is bigger than Donald Rumsfeld. This is about changing course in Iraq, and the president demonstrating to the American people he understands America cannot stay the course when the present course is taking our country in the wrong direction.
Republican leaders, though, have called this move election season politics. But Democrats cite the $300 billion cost of the war, the weekly attacks in Iraq, and the death of 2,600 U.S. soldiers as reasons to change course. They're also proposing a phased redeployment of troops beginning this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is warning the Sudan that it will bear responsibility if the humanitarian crisis in Darfur worsens. Annan's statements came as the African Union confirmed it will withdraw its peacekeeping troops from Darfur at the end of September. In August, the UN Security Council approved a UN force of over 20,000 to deploy in Darfur after the African Union's troops departed, but the Sudanese government has refused to admit the peacekeepers and has instead deployed 10,000 of its own troops to the area. Joshua Kilimpa reports.
The demand by the government of Sudan for African Union forces to pack their bags and leave the troubled nation was announced by its foreign minister spokesman Ahmed Ibrahim yesterday.
They said that by the end of September, they may not be able to continue with their assignment in Darfur. So we are just requesting now, since they can't proceed with their assignment in Darfur, it is up to them now to leave. It is not the decision of the Sudan. It is indicated before by the African Union itself. We are asking them, please leave.
The foreign ministry's announcement came after reports that Sudan has already deployed about 10,000 of its troops to the remote western region. But Kofi Annan has warned that should humanitarian aid agencies, which have been feeding about 3 million people in camps, leave Darfur for lack of security, the Sudanese government would have to answer to the rest of the world. Many are concerned that Sudan is planning a full-scale war by deploying its troops and by resisting the deployment of UN forces. However, Foreign Minister Lam Akol says there are two distinct agreements with different mandates.
There's no provision which calls for the UN to come. And that is a problem which people can't understand. We are telling them that if you change the troops, you are violating the agreement, because the agreement talks about AU. It doesn't talk about UN. We are not kicking out AU troops. We are telling them that there is no agreement between the two parties and therefore want them to stay their position. Do they still want to pull out as they have said, or there is a change of mind?
The Comprehensive Peace Agreement in Southern Sudan calls for UN peacekeepers, while the Darfur Peace Agreement has a provision to use African Union troops. The Sudanese government is asking the African Union to leave because the AU wants the UN to take over peacekeeping duties, a suggestion Sudan strongly rejects. The African Union says they don't have the money to maintain a presence in Darfur. Meanwhile, UN Humanitarian Relief Coordinator Jan Egeland says the situation in the Darfur region of Sudan has worsened in recent months.
We have recorded more than 100% increase in violent attacks, clashes, this first half year of 2006 compared to the first half of 2005. And 2005 was a bad year. So it's going from really bad to catastrophic in Darfur.
Last week, the Security Council voted 12-0, dispatched 12,500 UN soldiers and 3,000 UN police. The resolution requires the consent of Khartoum before implementation. But the Sudanese government is reported to have already sent at least 10,000 of its own troops to the Darfur region. Western nations and human rights groups say that could make matters worse. Jan Egeland adds that it is of great urgency that UN troops deploy to Darfur.
There has to be agreement on a UN force. There has to be a robust security force in Darfur. The African Union forces are not able to bring the situation under control.
In 3 years of fighting, some 200,000 people have been killed, and according to the UN, more than 2 million driven from their homes. The Sudanese government has vehemently rejected that killings, rape, and displacement are continuing in Darfur, despite the presence of African Union peacekeepers. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Right-wing Mexican presidential candidate Felipe Calderon started forming his government today, a day after the country's federal election commissioner certified him the winner. Calderon prevailed by a razor-thin margin in an election marred by allegations of fraud. His left-wing rival, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, says he will never recognize the results and vowed to form a parallel government. Thousands of López Obrador's supporters have been camped out in Mexico City for months, demanding a recount. But that request was denied. Gilberto López Rivas is an anthropologist with the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico City and a frequent contributor to the Mexican newspaper La Jornada. He says many Mexicans will never respect Calderón as their president.
I think Calderón is not a real president, but a fraudulent president. And one-third of the Mexican people think that Calderón is an illegitimate president.
What do you think will happen now? You have thousands of people who have been camped out in central Mexico City ever since the election, protesting for a recount that did not happen. You had President Vicente Fox's last report to Congress disrupted by deputies of the PRD last week. What do you think will happen now that the Election Commission has formally certified Calderón as the president?
Well, I think the movement is going to continue in a different way. 16th of September is going to be open the National Democratic Assembly, and that's going to be the beginning of a new form of resistance. But also, at the same time, Calderón and the ruling class is going to begin this media campaign against this resistance movement. As a matter of fact, it began today, especially all the newspapers, the TV, the radio, all are talking about national unity, about supporting the new president, and we have to be united, Mexicans have to be united. But this is an empty talking, and I think that millions of Mexicans like myself are going to do the resistance against this next government.
What do you think people can expect from Felipe Calderón as president, separate from all of this controversy? He is the same party as Vicente Fox, who was formerly head of Coca-Cola in Mexico before he became the president. What is his program? What will he try to do as the next president of Mexico?
Well, he will continue all the program of Fox. That means a very, very good relation with the United States and corporation of the United States. He will be a friend of neoliberal system. He will be a follower of this corporation transnational system. We expect repression with Calderón government. He is a people from the right-wing apparatus. He's young. He is only about 44 years old. But with all the mentality of right-wing people, with Catholic tradition, he's a kind of a pragmatic, a very conservative politician, more smart than Fox, and for that reason, more dangerous than Fox.
Gilberto López Rivas is an anthropologist with Mexico's National Institute of Anthropology and History and a frequent contributor to the newspaper La Jornada. He spoke with us from Mexico City. Israel's Auditor General is demanding a criminal investigation into Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. The investigation would probe political appointments Olmert made when he was government minister before Ariel Sharon slipped into a coma earlier this year. It's the latest salvo against Olmert, who has been under intense pressure since the war in Lebanon ended. He's facing calls for a judicial commission to investigate Israel's political and military conduct during the war. His coalition government looks shaky, with it unlikely they'll be able to pass a budget this year. Iris Mackler reports from Jerusalem.
The pressure is building on Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, with attacks coming from all directions, including members of the public, members of the armed forces, and, naturally, rival politicians from all parties, including his own. First, the most important group, the voters. The Israeli public has made it plain that it's dissatisfied with the conduct of the recent month-long war in Lebanon. For the third week, protesters gather in tents outside Israel's parliament, the Knesset. There are various groups, including activists, as well as reserve soldiers who fought in Lebanon. A few soldiers are on a hunger strike to call attention to what they say was the poor conduct of the war and to demand an inquiry. Moshe Krantz's son was a soldier on the front line in Lebanon.
We have the perfect storm here of three inexperienced people in the three key positions, and they're busy playing poker with themselves, they're busy playing politics with themselves, but meanwhile there's a real enemy, there's a real wolf outside the door. This current leadership could end the Commonwealth of Israel. That's how seriously I feel about it.
Krantz's son returned from Lebanon with complaints that the operation was disorganized, that entire units were unprepared for battle, and that intelligence and equipment was lacking, including food and even water. Concerns about this and other aspects of the war, especially conflicts between the military and the inexperienced political leaders, have led other groups to join the protest. One is the Movement for Quality Government, an Israeli non-profit organization. Daniel Kairos is its spokesman.
The realistic and also the fair and the democratic way to go about it is a commission of inquiry. I always like to recommend to myself and to others that you usually try to reach conclusions on the basis of facts. So first we need some objective fact-finding here.
But Prime Minister Olmert is resisting a full-scale judicial inquiry. The government has set up a number of smaller inquiries instead. One established by the Defense Department was closed down before it had even met once. And the second inquiry will have to be reconvened, after Israel's top law officer last night disqualified two former generals from sitting on the inquiry panel due to conflicts of interest. While Prime Minister Olmert is rushing to find replacements, it's not clear that his coalition government will survive the upcoming budget vote. The finance minister is proposing a tough budget, cutting social services to pay for the war effort. And Olmert's coalition partners are rebelling. The army is asking for an increase in funding to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars following the war. And the Labour Party, the Pensioners Party, and the ultra-orthodox Shas Party all say they cannot agree to a budget like this. For the past 24 hours, Olmert has been in negotiations to save the budget and the coalition government. If he can do that, he's considering a cabinet reshuffle in order to breathe new life into his government, even though he's been in office less than 6 months. This instability has led rivals inside his Kadima party to start preparing to challenge him for the party leadership. The sharks are also circling in the Labour Party, preparing to challenge Labour leader Amir Peretz, who, whether fairly or not, was perceived as being a poor defence minister during this war. Polls show that a majority of Israelis think he should resign. Meanwhile, Israel has announced that it will lift its air and sea blockade of Lebanon tomorrow. The announcement follows information from the United Nations that the international forces are ready to take over control of Lebanon's air and sea ports. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
The United Nations Population Fund released its annual State of the World Population Report today. This year's edition examines the scope and breadth of female migration on source and destination countries and their disproportionate vulnerability to trafficking, exploitation, and abuse. The report reveals that although migrant women contribute billions of dollars in cash and services, policymakers continue to disregard both their contributions and their vulnerability. Even though female migrants tend to send a much higher proportion of their lower earnings back home to their male counterparts. Dunuda Jefranyets reports from New York.
Today, half of all international migrants, 95 million, are women and girls. They migrate to marry or to work, seeking labor or simply a better life. While in host countries, they work endless hours and send home funds to support families and communities. Yet, despite substantial contributions to both their families at home and communities abroad, the needs of migrant women continue to be ignored. One of the largest labor sectors driving international female migration is domestic work. Reports from around the world show that domestic workers have been assaulted, raped, denied pay, rest days, privacy, and psychologically abused, according to Laura Lasky, a coordinator of the adolescent program at the United Nations Population Fund. The private nature of their work easily can expose these women into severe jeopardy.
One of the main low-skilled jobs that women do when they migrate, they get employed in the domestic work. They take care of babies, take care of families, of elder people. And of course, what happens is that because they are in a private setting, the abuses that are committed to them are really not in the public.
One of the most horrific cases of migration mentioned in the report is human trafficking. The International Labour Organization estimates that almost 2.5 million trafficked victims are exploited worldwide. An estimated 600,000 to 800,000 people are trafficked across international borders each year. Of these, 80% are women and girls. They are usually forced into sex work, domestic or sweatshop labor. According to Lasky, the solution lies both in the hands of the source and destination countries.
What countries can do, particularly countries affected by trafficking, is to persecute the perpetrators. Then there is the life of the girls. They need a lot of support in terms of giving them mental health services and recover them for the social life and reintegrate them in their own countries. This is very important because usually the families of these girls, when they come back, or even the societies, do reject them without really understanding what had happened to them.
This year's UNFPA report is also accompanied by a special youth supplement. The young migrating men and women profiled in Moving Young come from 10 countries: Burkina Faso, Colombia, India, Kenya, Liberia, Moldova, the Netherlands, the Philippines, Suriname, and Zambia. One of them is Khadisha Al-Murabit, a 26-year-old Moroccan student born in Amsterdam. She says that it was difficult for her to get integrated into her host country.
I don't feel more Dutch or more Moroccan. I grew up in two cultures. I cannot say I'm this or that. I am both. Life isn't black and white. So is my identity. There have been several occasions that somebody was on the street and the emotions were very high with that person. And then there was a problem maybe. And he would say, well, go back to your own country. And I was standing there and I was like, well, this is my country. Where do I have to go? And if you do something wrong yourself, where do you have to go?
The launch of the State of World Population 2006 report comes just a week before the high-level dialogue on international migration and development in New York. This meeting, which will take place at the United Nations from the 14th to 15th of September, is the first of its kind to bring together the world's governments to discuss the challenges and benefits of migration. One of the issues that will be discussed is young migrants, which so far has been overlooked, although they do migrate in the biggest numbers. I'm Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Simba Russo and Monica Lopez produce our newscast. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. For archives of this or any other newscast, please visit our website at www.fsrn.org, www.fsrn.org. In Berkeley, I'm Aaron Glantz, sitting in for Aldo Bogado.